Okay, I think we should start. Thanks everybody for coming. The seminar today is by a person who is quite close to the Hellenic Observatory. Indeed, it's his second time who's giving a presentation in this seminar series, the first one quite a few years back. Platon Tinios is in many respects considered to be an expert, if not the expert, on the Greek pension system. He's assistant professor at the University of Piraeus, and he's currently visiting senior fellow here at the Hellenic Observatory. He has studied previously in the UK, in Cambridge, where he also completed his PhD, and before that in Oxford. And he has served as special advisor to the Prime Minister in Greece from 1996 to 2004, and I guess that's also a wealthy experience of with the pension system, but not only with the pension system. Also covered areas not only of social security, but also health and national economy. He was also a member of the EU Social Protection Committee from 2000 to 2004. His research includes, obviously, pensions, but not only pensions, the issue of aging, the demographics of it and the economics of it, social policy, gender, and issues of labor economics and public finance. His presentation today is on pension poor and housing rich, so touching on the pension issue, but also to wider questions, obviously, in Greece. Platon.
Right. Thank you very much. It's an honor to be here, and it's even better that it's been such a long time since the previous presentation, because you won't remember what I said. And that is actually the starting point, is what do you do, what do you write about a thing which doesn't change, which is, you could reproduce the stuff I wrote in the 80s, and Janis Krauss is here, and he's suffered himself, so... And, of course, I have a whole year to fill here at the LSE. So the question is, try to find something new. So what I will present now is the general outline, is the frame out of which the sprawling Russian novel, if you like, out of which I might get those one or two clever little flash fiction things that you can actually publish in academic journals nowadays. So... this is the Russian novel. And any ideas for flash fiction, they're very welcome. So, the aging frame, the Greek crisis is presented either as a micro crisis to do with reform and or as a part of European architecture that's completely macro price, so the external ring. Here, I thought I might actually look at it in a slightly different frame and look at it as an example of population aging and the structure of intergeneral relations. And if you see it that way, it explains certain parts of both the crisis and the types of response it engendered, and it also highlights links between different policy areas which are usually put in different boxes: housing, care, labour, and pensions. And what is the interesting thing? I mean, Greece is interesting if you see it in the ageing, because certain things which are people who have dealt with ageing have been anticipating for a very long time, and Janis Braus can tell us about this. In fact, appear to have been telescoped in a few months in Greece. So the idea of the extended pretend way of dealing with pensions is something which is very well known in all pension systems, and they find various ways of essentially postponing painful decisions forward, and they might find good reasons for postponing it or bad reasons, but essentially the aging showdown in most countries is something that is in the future and can only be guessed at now. Well, in Greece, we don't actually have to do very much guessing, because we were present at the Judgment Day last summer. So, and what the crisis has done is forcing us to reconsider the social contract, the pension social contract, more or less on a first principles basis. So four vignettes about how pensions are related to the Greek crisis. Now, every stage of the crisis seems to have pension reform. It started with pension reform, it ended with pension reform, and as we speak, there is pension reform offering, even after people in August said, well, you know, this is the end because the Troika has finally decided that this is what's going to be it, and we still don't know what will happen. Secondly, I think the very interesting things which a lot of people should be losing a lot of sleep over is the link with the sovereign debt crisis. Now, we have a hierarchy of obligations. Repaying the IMF is a legal obligation, it's a very strong legal obligation. Paying pensions is a weak legal obligation, but a very strong moral obligation. And what we saw in June is that the moral and the ethical obligation overcame the legal one. In choosing between paying the IMF and paying pensions, and the Greek government decided to pay pensions. And interestingly, this was a stance which was seen with understanding by the institutions. I think that they essentially said that any government in this position would have reacted in pretty much the same way. What this means is that the time structure of paying pensions and repaying national debt have to be looked at the same time. They're both instances of hypothecating future output. Now, the third point is, Jan Spras will remember that, when the Spras report had come up and said that you have, 1997, said you have 10 years to decide, because after 1997 the system will become bankrupt, we won't have any more money. And Polis Oropoulos, the head of the Confederation of Workers, said, well, there's no need to worry, because the state will go bankrupt long before the pension system, and he was right. It did go bankrupt before the pension system. And why did it do it? Because the state insisted on giving reassurances to all and sundry. So in the same way that AIG, the insurance firm in the States, managed to guarantee all subprimes, and everyone who had a subprime thought they had purchased sufficient insurance so they could behave as though there was no risk, but there was a single insurer who were collecting all the risk of the system. In the same way, the state had tried to reassure everyone and in the end collapsed itself. And finally, one thing that will probably be understood is the, in the background of this is the issue of electoral aging. In the economic theory of democracy, the median voter is decisive, he's a dictator, and aging, plus the electoral behavior of different age groups, the fact that the young in recent elections have decided not to participate, has meant that the average age of the decisive voter has advanced by possibly up to 10 years, which is a difference between someone who is involved in the world of work and perhaps worried about children, how their schools and things, and someone who's close enough to pensions that, well, of course, it does help that Greek pensions are quite have the possibility of low retirement, but he feels in different ways. Now, there are some local paradoxes, and quite the person who managed to elbow me out of my proper slot last week actually fell into every one of them. He did say that he repeated to his prime minister that we must not cut pensions because the grandmothers give pensions to their unemployed grandchildren. And that, he reported as a truism. Now, that has two problems. One is that why it's a second best. So why not go straight for the first best and give money to the grandchildren? And secondly, it shows that he might not understand how the pension economics. He needs someone to pay the pensions in order for the grandmother to have it. But nevertheless, the fact that so many people think that that is a wise thing in Greece tells you quite a lot about Greek society, Greek family, and various idiosyncrasies which you can't ignore. Similarly, again, Tsakalotos, the measure, I think, was an answer to your own question. Why is a left-wing party so resistant to going towards the guaranteed minimum income and persisting on the sort of patchwork of money given to all and sundry? And in the negotiation, this was cited as one of the reasons why the Greek population had to go towards the referendum, because the commission was insisting on this. And finally, there seems to be a persistent inability or unwillingness to adapt the pre-crisis narrative. We keep arguing about things without realizing that the underlying structure of things have changed. For example, one of the stylized facts that everyone kept repeating was that pensioners are poor. Now, as it so happens, pensioners are no longer poor. And as a direct result of the crisis, pensioner poverty has fallen 7 percentage points. But everyone talks as though that the pensioners are the poor to be protected. So, what I'm trying to do is try to use a distance between Athens and the LSE to gain some sort of perspective on the intergenerational exchanges, to give you an overall narrative. And at the end, and this is where the title of the presentation comes in, give you a precise example where there should be a solution, but in order to try and find that solution, you have to expend quite a lot of effort and thought, which are apparently the things which are in short supply. So, the pre-crisis social contract, this is reasonably well known. Now, one of the interesting things that people don't know about Greek pensions, and I mention to them and they say, aha, is that Greek pensions are actually a direct contemporary, and they're almost identical to US Social Security, because they were set up at more or less the same time, and they're both state-of-the-art 1930s pay-as-you-go Bismarck-type social insurance systems. Now, ICA was legislated in 1934, US Social Security in 1936. Now, if you actually compare what happened in the intervening period, it's there was a world of difference. I mean, there's the two systems which started in the same, they had the same blueprint, but one is still there and quite healthy, and the other is a disaster. And the two key differences, I explained the two fortunes, the divergent fortunes. On the ones, we have the input of governance. The Greek system was essentially abandoned to its fate. And for example, whereas in the States there's an annual report to Congress about the actuarial prospects of the system, there's the legal requirement to do this in Greece, but it was always ignored. And secondly, and that's the original sin of the Greek pension system, is the problem of fragmentation. So you have fragmentation every possible way. And in a pay-as-you-go system, which the pay-as-you-go system works by mimicking what is happening inside a family on the national level. So it gets current workers to pay for current pensioners. And that's fine, system, or it's fine under conditions that we know about. But if you try to have such a system and at the same time have fragmented providers by occupation, it's very easy to use it as an instrument in a different kind of game, which is the game of buying privileges. So the game of getting one group to benefit at the expense of others. And this, the within generation rather than between generation system dominated, and the pension system ended up.
Yeah. So by pension tranche, what does that mean?
Well, you have primary pensions, supplementary or auxiliary pensions, and you have separation amounts. So you have,
Thank
you. So it's by you have by occupation, you have by different kinds of pension tranches, and you also have by date of first contact. So you have a by corporate. So the role that the pension system should play as there's the between generation solidarity atrophies. So as the pensions were used for other reasons. So and the costs were shifted to others. And at the macro level, this fragmentation also meant that there was the pensions were a key determinant of fiscal deficits, and by removing the budget constraint, they allowed government expenditure to and government borrowing to grow. And this became even worse after 2001 and Euro membership, because it was much easier to borrow. So it was when the repeated attempts to pass the same reform were the costs of retreating were much lower under the euro than previously, which explains why the 1992 reform, 1990-92 reforms were a little more courageous than the 2001-2008. So in 2009, pensions were a mechanism for disaster. That's the demographic pyramids. They were costly. They faced dramatic challenges. They're socially ineffective. They're resistant to change. And one thing that I want to stress, and it's going to be very important, I think it's already important, but people don't realize how much it is. There is a twist in Greek demography, because the Greek baby boom was rather late, and because it was a very sudden drop in fertility in 1980. Those two things together mean that there is a shift in there's a acceleration in deterioration, demographic deterioration after 2015. That's been known for a long time. That means that demographic factors, which are the sort of thing that people take for granted, are going to be playing a much more important role, if not a very visible role, in the time to come. So you have a pension system which does all kinds of things except provide security at old age. Now, given that you want some security at old age, what do you do? The answer is you try to find some other ways of providing income support on the one hand and direct care provision on the other. The usual suspects when it comes to this, of course, are the women. And the pension system is ideally suited for this because it has a huge pension gender pension gaps, 36%, and a very large gender coverage gap. That means women who have no pension at all and usually have to rely on pensions as derived rights from their husbands. So that facilitates women staying at home and providing care, and is reflected in the very large labour market participation gaps in the EU, and the labour market is designed to encourage this by a two-speed labour market. Now, housing is the other thing. So we have very widespread owner occupation traditionally in Greece, which is spread throughout the income distribution, and the inheritance and gifts to offspring essentially play. They could be seen to be going in the opposite direction of care services. I'm not saying it's a quid pro quo, but it could be. So they could function such as an exchange of housing for care services and income support. There's a long story to be told there, because I think If you look at anthropological writings of the 50s and 60s, you find that there was the dowries then were had a different function to dowries and gifts for inter vivos now. Now they're much more unisex, whereas dowries then were a form of early inheritance. So, why is this democratic system of ownership of housing? Because of a series of one-off factors. It's important one-off factors because they cannot be repeated in the past. The housing deficit was made up in the 60s, at the time when there was a very widespread suspicion of on the parts of savers of non-real estate savings, and on the parts of the government of real estate investment, of housing investment. So the housing sector was essentially independent of the rest, and made do with various mechanisms to conserve liquidity, such as exchange arrangements and what the dowries we mentioned. What this ended up is small family-owned apartment buildings where the generations were living close to each other but not in the same flat. That was encouraged by tax policy. They had large transfer taxes, which meant that once a family had the building, had a house, they stayed there. And no property tax. So there was saving for housing was privileged, but the house moving was discouraged. One interesting thing, which again I think must play a role in the future, is that there is housing supposed to be characterized by a long cycle of about to 30 to 40 years duration, which is the time that it takes for houses physically to begin deteriorating and need major repairs or rebuilding. Now, that if there was a housing boom in the 60s and 70s, then the time when one should begin thinking about a long housing cycle would be more or less now. And that's important because housing investment is, we know historically, is very elastic to conditions in the money market, liquidity and finance. So there should, by rights, be a bottled-up demand, which at the moment is not doing very much. And there was no, in contrast with Spain and Ireland, there was a small housing bubble, which affected essentially only the middle class. And that was partly contained by the system of objective prices, which meant that mortgages were tended to be lower than the value of the house. And there was also the scandal of pension funds in 2006, which also worked to inoculate people against experimentation with exotic finance. Now, this is a picture of owner occupation. That's owner occupation in people over 50. So it's data from Share. What we see is that the people who are in extreme poverty, as the blue lines is Greece, their percentage of owner occupation is extremely high. So even the people who are in the depths of poverty have rates of owner occupation which are in excess of 60% or close to 80%. And owner occupation by income decile, it's completely flat always. Whereas in northern countries, there's a very strong income grazing. Right. So, I mean, this was the.
You're doing well this time. So.
Well, I have to go a little bit faster on the crisis. Now, what is the crisis? The crisis essentially means that we have a general need to adapt downwards. We start off with the fact that GDP per head in 2015 is something like 26-27%. Lower than it was in 2008. This is not a simple arithmetic observation because it has very definite implications for a system with pension system where the rights are actually defined on largely on 2008 situation. That means that if any right which is derived from an entitlement defined on pre-2008 is going to be larger than what the economy can bear. And another way of looking at it is if there are certain groups of the population who are legally protected from adapting to the general fall, that means that there must be greater adjustment on the parts of the other parts of the population. So, and not to mince my words, it's a question of you protecting the older generation at the expense of the younger generation. And it also means that there has to be, if there is a sequential process, and as each group comes along and has its claim adjudicated and then leaves, the group at the end will end up paying much more than the rest. What is happening at the moment is something like a sequential period. And there's never been any discussion of how to adjust and to what extent has to be adjust, because this is a discussion which has not taken place in Greece at all. Now, that was the first observation. The second observation I already mentioned is this aging and debt. The long-term planning has to plan for both meeting external debt and paying pensions. And whatever processes decide, it has to be forward-looking and it has to also deal with this generational balance, which is something that the third memorandum of understanding seems to understand, because it talks about social justice both across and within generation. And but it's still something which is needed. Now, what has happened in this political economy? In the time before 2009, there was a lot of talk. Well, some people talked, and lots of other people talked over them, but certainly no action. And that was replaced with this exact opposite. So there's a lot of action by the Troika, as long as it's blamed on someone outside, and no talk. As a result, hardly anyone knows where we are and what's happened and what we need to do. For instance, in the case of pensions, it was the first law that was passed and the first bailout, but that was supplemented by at least four others, probably more, until 2014, and we're expecting more to come. And despite 5 years of very confused implementation, reform is again at the centre of the attention now. And this misunderstanding is compounded by two two types of things. Firstly, the term structure of reform, because the reforms did two things which were somewhat contradictory. They tried to have steady state provisions for the very long term, so secure viability. So that's provisions that affect the very young, the entrance to the system. And then they have medium-term provisions which were largely to be applied for the generation who is to retire in this decade. So they're trying two different things there. And then there's another thing, the exogeneity of response. There were some actions which were proactive, who were chosen. And then there was a number of other actions which turned up in practice as reactions to things such as public finance problems, the need to find to fill gaps, etc., which is all the story to do with the pension reductions. So between those two things, it's understandable that hardly anyone, except myself, of course, understands where we are. And the three faces of pension reforms are the three faces of January. It's a very good book by Patricia Highsmith. Now, the three faces of pension reform. Firstly, is a new system for labour entrants who face a far less generous system, which is two-tiered. There's step increases in retirement ages to 67, so Greece from having some of the lowest effective retirement ages now has gone, certainly for the young, to a system which has the highest retirement age and the least flexible. And pensions are calculated on career earnings, which is one way of making sure that they're lower. Now, that's the first thing. The second thing is a very determined attempt, repeated determined attempt, to protect the baby boom through what are known as grandfathering measures, as various exceptions of people who are close to retirement. And that largely exempts the cohorts who are due to retire by 2020. So everyone knows about Greek hairdressers who are entitled to early retirement. This, after the pressure of the Troika, was abolished, but it was abolished in the sense that they kept everybody happy, because it was abolished in the sense that new hairdressers were not entitled to early retirement, but all those who had 10 years as hairdressers, or could claim 10 years as hairdressers, retained the existing rights. So that meant that they could support, without fear of contradiction, they have abolished the question of the hairdressers, but at the same time, no hairdresser is going to be upset for the next 10 or 15 years. And thirdly, which is something that is people who are not in the minutiae of the Greek system find very hard to understand, is it's the attempt to retain this rather baroque feature of the Greek pension system, which are the system of auxiliary pensions. Auxiliary pensions are pensions which are all employees get on top of their primary pension. So primary pensions give something like 80% replacement, and auxiliary give another 20. And apart from that, they're completely identical. In economic terms, they're identical to primary pensions. So what's all the fuss about? And then that primary auxiliary pensions are dedicated dedicated in the sense that the trade union movement is much more closely involved in their governance and administration than the primary system, partly because it's more fragmented. And as a result, the trade union movement tries to keep the pension system, the auxiliary pension system, independent in order to maintain their influence.
Isn't the auxiliary pensions part of the second pillar, kind of occupational pensions?
No. Not? It's a question of it's their pay as you go, the mandatory defined benefit. They're identical. They're occupational in the sense that they're more closely related to occupations, but they're not second pillar in the sense of being pre-funded or allowing someone to switch from one occupation to the other. So there's a lot of ink that was spent in the independence of auxiliary pension. I mention it because this is one of the main bones of contention at the moment. And it's what has turned out is something like a pay-as-you-grab system. Which is a system, well, it's very funny if you want, but it pay as you grab, I think, is an accurate description. It means that, you know, the few cohorts who will retire now will be able to get quite a lot more than the poor people who are now paying for those pensions. What has turned out is that the long-term viability was secured at the expense of near-term instability. The protection of the polytechnic generation today is the polytechnic, we have to protect them, of course. So everyone had a vested right meant that there were those who were facing retirement were dealing with the old system, which was much more generous. While at the same time, for the low pensions, especially for the low pensions, pensions became much more generous in relation to work time earnings than previously. And you can see this in this diagram. The blue lines is the projections before the reform. The other ones are the projection after the reform. up until 2020, there really is no difference. And then the after the projections after the reform begin to have quite a big difference after 2025. So the pension system viability was solved at the expense, well, on paper, in a sense, as something that is due to happen in 2025. What has that meant? That you had the system very generous, and the doors were still wide open, and people, of course, used that to try to escape from the pressures of the labour market. Well, you had waves of early retirements, at the same time as contribution revenue was falling. In the system of the post memorandum system, if you have a fiscal surprise of this kind, you have to finance it from inside the system, and the easiest way of financing was to cut pensions. And so what they did is they went along and cut pensions again and again and again 10 times. They cut the same people's pensions as previously, and as a result they had cumulative cuts of up to 50%. Now, it's up to 50% of a small minority of unfortunates who are to get the larger pensions. But interestingly, the low pensions only lost the two holiday bonuses, so they fell by 14%, whereas low income, low earnings fell by 30%. So for those at low income and close to retirement age, the pension system still appeared a really good deal, which is why they rushed to the exit. This situation, anyone says everything. While this misperception of pensions have been cut by 40%, is something about FACU says repeated. They haven't, and that's why old age poverty has fallen from 22% to 13%. The neoliberal agenda, the new system is completely state. A system relies on the state completely. Has no element of pre-funding, and it's a system that has chosen continuity over systemic change. This system was imposed from the outside, but the Troika was moving things along, and everybody was saying there is no alternative, Tina. But the Troika proposals are not radical. I mean, they just took the kind of ideas that were around anyway and just implemented. So what the Troika essentially produced is a system as it ought to have been, rather than looking to the future. For the next 20 years, it's essentially we will be the old system plus the arbitrary cuts that will rule, and the new system is essentially a revamped system of the 50s. And the shape of pension failure, you see it there. At the time when there's four, that's the percentage of pensions in GDP from 2001 into 2012. So 2012 is the last date on which we have comparative data. So despite all the pension reforms and all the cuts and the percent of the passage of consecutive laws, we still have, it's 2012, 17.5%. In 2013, reportedly, it's fallen because the cuts, the Venizelos cut of 2013 have been factored in. But it's interesting that we can't get this data. You see, the reaction to the failure is to suspend the publication of data showing the failure. So we just have to wait until things are reported in Eurostat before we'll... So it's 2012. That's due to early retirements, rise in social payments, the collapse of the denominator. The GDP is down by a quarter. That means that, and it does not include the 2013 cuts. If you were to include the revenue side, it would be even worse. So, the pension redistribution that took place, and that is incidentally something Six minutes, all right. That is incidentally something which I will probably try to do during my time here, trying to use the data, and I'll tell you what kind of data it is, to try to actually pin this down. Is my feeling is that by generation there is the old and the young are being made to pay for the middle generation, the polytechnic, and by size of pensions, the different cuts by pension size, that has meant to dilute any kind of social insurance coverage. You must remember that the cuts, the arbitrary ad hoc cuts, unless something is changed in the next weeks, will characterize the next 20 years. The new system, if at all, will be what the people who retired after 2030 will get. Up until 2030, you will get this funny mix of old and young. By gender, the attempt to retain the key differences was abandoned, but it was abandoned for those who were not lucky enough to exercise a right. So those who were not, that did not apply to retire before August 2015, women especially, face an increase in having to work for another up to 17 years. So the key characteristics, the two characteristics, is abruptness and lack of justification. So both together promote exactly the opposite of what pension systems are supposed to safeguard, which is the feeling of security. So the only thing they do is they promote insecurity, and the life cycle planning insofar as it's been severely disturbed, and the people who are affected most are not the very young, not the people who are now entering the labour market, because they have the time to make provisions, but the people halfway who will have realised that they've been duped, but they haven't got the time to do anything about it. I gave you the imponderables about pensions. There are imponderables about labour and care work. I'll try to go a little bit faster because I actually want to get to the bit which justifies the title of my talk. The point is, I'd like to start with where I ended, is the fact that there will be an increase, a quite abrupt increase in the supply of labour or people over 50. Through the closing of the retirement gates, which was going to affect the situation from next year on. Unless something is done to the demand for labour, these people will just join the unemployed, because there is nothing that is there is no labour market for new hires of people over 50, and the structure of earnings in the structure of wages rather in most occupations is very age related, so, which means that someone over 50 is cost much more than someone who's young. The housing, as you know, was essentially treated during the bailout as a kind of batteries storing historical tax evasion, and that a lot of people felt that gave them the right to tax. To tax it to non-existence. So the market at the moment is moribund. However, there is a major realignment of portfolio taking place, and in which case housing, even though it's been severely hit by taxation, is not clear that it is not a desirable asset. Because at the moment, people are taking the money out of the country. So in terms of internal assets, the jury's still out about what will happen to housing. The question is, will there be a housing price collapse or not? That is a question which there is no answer to. So, post-crisis.
2 minutes.
Now, the point of this is, where the LSE and the Hellenic Observatory comes in is there's a need for policy entrepreneurship. So policy entrepreneurship means that, you know, you have to do a little bit of thinking and saying, well, you know, you can't just do the same things we've always done. because the situation is a little different. The saying things we've always done means this what I can call the confrontational paradigm. So where the state takes the leading role, says, you know, I'm going to try to do everything, and then people try to fill in as they come. As the things stand at the moment, the state persists in promising it would cover the lion's share of the risks. Now, you may believe it, you may not. If you don't believe it, you have to make provision for yourself. But looking forward, the pension system places an increasing burden on production, the tightening up of the retirement ages and the consolidation which is taking place, it will probably mean that after a certain time, the Greek pension system will actually start facing the opposite problem of what it had, that it would be too restrictive rather than too open, which is something which, again, is not being addressed. The position of women is that is also open to question, and housing as a chief intergenerational store of value is also challenged. Now, what you could do, I mean, there's a macro solution, and I'll give you a micro solution, and the two things have different issues of policy entrepreneurship. The macro solution will be something like a multi-pillar system. What the multi-pillar system essentially does is it defines aging as a common problem and tries to find an architecture where the various actors involved in the economy can actually cooperate rather than try to elbow each other out under the peasant system. So you have the first pillar is the state to finance general societal solidarity. Where you can focus more or less on poverty, but poverty, old age poverty, will be the main thing. Second pillar would be occupational, which would allow departures from the general norm. This is my point about the system being too restrictive. An occupation where, for example, like lawyers, who carry on working until they drop, could try to organize themselves in such a way that they could have benefits different from other groups. And finally, the third pillar, life cycle saving, where my point about housing finance will come along. Now, I mentioned there's a specific problem, and there should be a specific answer. The 1980s cohort, the people born in the 1980s. I mean, they're the people who are suffering from the surprise and the abruptness of the system. I would think that this group of people are the ones who will be most hit by the changes that have taken place, in the sense that their consumption at retirement will be most constrained. Both the ones previously and the ones after will be better off. Now, that particular group of people will not have the time to accumulate or to save for themselves, but at the same time, they are a group that have quite large housing investments, so that their house, they're pension poor but housing rich. Now, if you put it this way, there's a problem that could have a simple solution, is try to convert housing capital to pension capital, and which is, and all over the world, old people, one of the common problems is that old people live in very large, inappropriate houses, and they're facing, while at the same time the standard of living is very low, while on paper they should be rich. So, and they resist moving, they resist trading down, and so the question, I mean, there is a sort of a a question for policy entrepreneurs. How can you turn housing wealth to command over resources and income security at old age specifically? That on paper is a sort of problem that should be soluble. You can prove that there should be a solution, but at the same time, the solution seems to evade just about everyone. And it's the reverse mortgages, equity release, I think they're called here in the UK, are exactly such a mechanism that allow the release of equity and also allow the old people to stay in their old in the houses, whilst they're essentially receive a loan, which will be repaid after they die. And the paradox about this is that why it has spread so little, even in places where it's been around for quite a while, and there's a lot of incentives and a lot of explanation, like the US and the UK are the two countries where they have tried to get this market moving, but with not very spectacular results. Now, in places like Italy and Greece, the advantages of reverse mortgages are even bigger. Venti and Wise, when they looked at this issue in the 80s for the US, they said, well, one of the reasons why it will not, this business, this reverse mortgages will not be attractive is that, and will not be socially interesting, put like this, is that the poor do not have housing capital. But that is not the case, as we saw, not the case in Southern Europe at all. It's the poor. The poor are quite well endowed in housing. So the question remains, why doesn't it spread? There were some legislative initiatives in Italy which are trying to get this market moving, but there's still there's a lot of resistance. In Greece, there would be there's the usual adverse election, moral hazard, etc., the usual explanations why an insurance types market doesn't come up. But in Greece, we have an extra problem of legal titles, which the poor do have housing capital, but a lot of it is irregular housing, which cannot be exchanged because it's not been regularized. So the regularization of a real estate, it is important for in the field of aging, I tell. So it's the sort of thing that it's an idea that if you mention it to a Greek minister, he will immediately go and announce it next week. We will have reverse mortgages and we will solve the problem. But of course, it isn't that way. And it's the kind of thing that has to be studied. And you have to find out what are the obstacles and what you need to overcome them. And perhaps you might decide that it's a stupid idea and it's not worth looking at it at all. But whatever it is not something that you can just deal with in a week. Which is my point about policy entrepreneurship. And this gives me something to do. I mean, sort of like you do in the children, you give them productive employment for a year at the LSC. So I have all these micro data sets that I'll be able to use. The sample of tax returns from 2008 to 2013, which have already been worked on a little bit by Zulafakis and Yannitsis. The share data of the over 50 population, wave 6 will become available in June, so that will give us a panel of 3,500 people who we know were interviewed in the previous decade. The first time use survey was conducted by Elstat last year, and our usual friends, the household expenditure, so the idea is to try to get the distributional information and also try to test ideas like reverse mortgages, but on a consistent basis of microdata, which brings me to my original point about flash fiction. This is going to be the flash fiction. What you've heard is the Russian novel.
Okay, thank you, Platon. It's interesting, we ended up with this agenda. Yeah. Took a bit longer, but so we have...
It was a Russian novel.
It was. But very interesting. So we have less time for questions, but I hope we can have a good discussion.
Kevin. No doubt, like many other people, what I know of the Greek pension system is derived from Platon Timaeus. My question takes us back to the beginning. That is that in 2010, the Troika clearly imposed certain reforms, which, as you've explained, were largely implementing reforms or implementing actions which should have been done in the 60s and 70s. So, two questions, if I may. With whom did the Troika consult in 2010, do you think, about the reforms? And what would you wish the Troika to have done that they didn't, in the sense of could they have gone further?
Who did they consult? I think they had some ideas of their own which they applied. One was the idea of linking the retirement age to the life expectancy and increases in life expectancy, so there will be a recontracting every 10 years. They were very proud of that and they mentioned it. I think they were... Well, they talked to the officials, Kutrumanis, and so they were given something which was reasonably non-generous for the for the young population, and then they were taken a ride, I think, by some people when, for example, they agreed on changing the definition of what is an underage child. And as a result of the Troika intervention, the underage children could be up to 30 years old. At the time when their mother was giving the early retirement in order to look after them, the underage child for which the early retirement was given could be up to 30 years old. That was... it was managed to be squeezed in to this very severe... law of 2010. So it gives you an idea of the sort of thing that was taking place, and of course it was done very in a great rush and without possibility of discussion, and the committee which existed at the time just made sure that it was not consulted and did not involve themselves at all. So there was a committee that was set up, that had been set up by Andreas Papandreou, by George Papandreou, and the committee did not produce any comment document, but the president of the committee gave all the documents submitted to the committee in a thick volume, Agios Theriou. Now, what would I have wished... would have happened. I would have wished for a little bit more discussion. Possibly a system of staggered... you would have a system of emergency measures, essentially, that would be explained as something gaining time so as to be able to do things properly and to try to find out what was the problem in order to work out what was the solution. And at the end of that, I still wanted, and I've actually written about this, an explicit multi-tier system where the state is much less ambitious than it is now. So rather than going for a replacement of around 80%, that would actually limit themselves to replacement of 30 to 40%, which is closely to what they would have the state provides, for example, in the Netherlands, and the rest would the rest are up to 70% would come up from occupational pensions, and I think the Greek system has a greater role for the third pillar because of mechanisms such as this. Mechanisms such as this, plus the very large number of self-employed and small businessmen.
If I may just very briefly, putting the onus more on the second pillar at a time of increasing unemployment, this seems to be exacerbating social inequity.
Well, you must remember that this would not be...
It
wouldn't be immediate. Plus, of course, kick-starting a system of funded pensions at a time when the stock market is depressed is actually pretty good, because you can work in all the capital gains will be to the benefit of the new system being set up.
I also have two questions. First, how about the relation between labor market reforms and pension reform? And I mean, we all know that the German sort of miracle, or even the British system, is very much based on this idea of flexible labor markets, opening up labor markets, and so on. So, to what extent do you think that the pay-as-you-go system is viable in light of the trend towards more flexible employment? And and when would this kind of flexicurity system actually happen in Greece? Second question, I'm more of a political economist. I was very interested in you said something about the voting behavior of pensioners, especially in light of the trend towards the aging of the median voter. There are a lot of puzzles here, and that's something that also interests me a lot. You would expect pensioners, especially people who are already taking a pension, to be much more risk averse and have a much shorter time horizon. So, to what extent do you think this is kind of explain the rise of Syriza and its consolidation in government? Even though it does offer a lot more stateless solutions and much more protective of state provisions, on the other hand, its strategy has been very high risk up to especially the summer negotiations, right? And actually, we ran a survey the day before the referendum, and we did find a clear correlation between age and voting behavior. So older people were much more in favor of yes. Even though there was a bit of a jump between in the ages right before retirement in favor of no, right? So there was a clear sort of in that sense. So I mean, where do you see what are the long term political implications of this aging of the median voter in Greece?
Right, the flexibility. I mean, I think to be fair to the Troika, they were aware that there is a link between pensions and flexibility. So in the first memorandum, they were quite detailed. There were supposed to be... pension reform was supposed to have been followed by labour reform, but they hadn't taken on board the factor of Luca Cazzelli in the Labour Ministry, who managed not to implement anything. And the thing about labour reform, it was a little bit like trench warfare in the First World War, to begin with, when the Troika was not quite into the idiosyncrasies of Greek labour law. What they did is they had singled on a number of things to change, which were necessary but not sufficient conditions. I mean, so they changed one thing, and they discovered that even if you change this one thing, there are other three or four other things behind it which serve the same purpose. So there was a number of attempts to change the labour markets, certainly in 2010 and 2011, and they did not start becoming effective until 2012, when it was the third attempt at labour reform. So, whereas there should have been labour and labour flexibility and pension reform should have been going hand in hand, it wasn't the case. Now, I actually agree with you that I don't think... I think pay-as-you-go in an economy such as Greece was a very large, small-scale industry is not a good idea. I mean, you have to have more occupational pensions and the kind of pensions geared towards the small businessman. And the small businessman, their obligation to pay social insurance contribution is one of their major problems at the moment, because there's a system of classes, which essentially means that a firm has to pay, a very small firm has to pay a certain amount regardless of turnover, year, month in, month out. And what's their reaction to this obligation is simply not to pay it. So there is the unpaid social insurance contribution for the self-employed are enormous. Now, that's another of the issues which are not being discussed. The last memorandum commits the government to introduce a proportional pension contributions for the self-employed, but this is interpreted with the Labour Ministry as something which has the old classes as floors, and from that floor on, there is a percentage contribution, which is, I mean, it's nonsense. But they have a point that unless, if you keep the current system, the current system of contributions, you cannot persist in giving out the kind of pensions that you had to the end. Now, voting behaviour, it's in places like Poland and Israel that the dedicated pensioners parties. In Greece, it hasn't come out like this. And one of the reasons, one of the interpretation of what Tsipras has been going on about, you shouldn't cut pensions in order to keep, is to, and it's an explicit justification, is try to preserve intergenerational solidarity by making sure that the lines, the hierarchies in the are kept inside the family. It is something, and I think if you were to look at this electoral aging, I think electoral aging in Greece is rather more complex. I think, as you have noticed, it is rather more complex than the simple economic theory of democracy model, because I think it works indirectly through the sort of questions and the way that things are discussed, rather than directly. This is one of the things that's quite very easy to do, is try to work out what exactly has happened to the age of the median voter. And my feeling is that it's probably the last election has dropped considerably because of the difference in participation. It's the young who didn't participate, not the old.
Can I ask a couple of questions? One related to what you were saying before about the self-employed and not paying contributions, and obviously we know that a large part of, or a significant part of the economy is informal economy, so there's no tax evasion, but also not employers' contributions and so forth. And I want to ask you to what extent this, correcting this, may give sufficient buffer for you know, a kind of more generous pension system or slower
tax evasion.
Yes, and basically contribution, employers' contributions. One aspect of the question. The other aspect of the question is that, because you also mentioned that you have to fix the system also for the self-employed,
mm-hmm.
but in many respects the self-employed is a problem of the economy. It's a problem of productivity, economies of scale, or whatever
mm-hmm.
it is. And it's a problem also of tax evasion, in the sense that, you know, it's very difficult to locate the evaders, very costly to penalize them, whereas, and you know, the incentives for them to evade are very high compared to larger companies where you want to have everybody on record, all your employees, it's easy to be identified by the tax authorities. So would then that change the you know, the suggestion that you made that we have to make the pension system work for the self-employed? Maybe we have to give more disincentives for self-employment and move to, you know, and then the occupational, you know, the second leg of the system work. Sorry, long question. But so one is informality, the other is self-employment. That's the question.
The problem about the self-employed is the way the system works is that their contributions are completely unrelated, and they see them as unrelated to the thing they get. So for them, social insurance is no different from taxation. So it's not really, and it's different in the sense that it's easier to evade. But so if you have a really not a very good tax, which is easier to evade, people will evade it. So I think the way to do it is to try, and one of the points about this the Swedish, I didn't go into it in any depth, but the Swedish notional defined contribution system. Is it gives people the idea that a new leaf has been turned. What that system does, it's a pay-as-you-go system. I mean, there's no for the bulk of the pension, you are not building reserves, but you are keeping a very careful track of how much people are saying are paying, and what happened, it became very popular in Sweden when, after just 1 year of operation, everyone working in Sweden got this orange envelope saying that, congratulations, Mr. or Miss Y, you have earned, you have paid so much into the social insurance, and this is going to grow at such and such a rate, and if you carry on like this, you'll be able to get a pension of X or Y. So it's a I think there is a fundamental difference of how you look at a pension system. I think a pension system, in order to work as a pension system, a social insurance, has to be seen as a system which exists for the young, for the contributors. Whereas in Greece, it's seen as a system which exists for the pensioners. So it's saying, well, you know, we have all these pensioners, and we want to make sure that we get the money, so let's find someone to pay it. And Mr. Obolis, for example, submitted in 2009 the YSE contribution to they submitted a list of 53 taxes which could be increased in order to finance in order to keep pensions exactly the same without changing anything to do with the structure of pensions. And now I think the little minds in Syriza are ticking very much in this direction, finding someone somewhere to pay for that. And there is, I mean, actually in Vauxhall there is the Institute of Intraplanetary Understanding or something.
Really?
It's a big building. And if we could tax the Martians, that'd be great.
No, the British would.
Oh, yeah.
And on the issue of
to the self-employed, I think the self-employed will have to contribute to the general societal solidarity, so the low national basic pension or whatever you have. But for their own occupational pension, there has to be something which can prove to them that it has something to give them. And being small businessmen, they actually understand what it means to save and how saving works. And presumably, well, the policy entrepreneurship, it can also, after a certain time, they might be able to borrow against their pension, accumulated pension contributions. Or you could think of various ways that would make participation in a pension system more attractive. And incidentally, the small medium enterprises problem is going to become much worse, because they will be shortly equated with farmers. And farmers have been used to getting everything and not paying nothing. So they will have to be, within the next 2 or 3 years, they're going to have to start being treated in the same way as small industrial firms. And it's going to be a shock.
Can I raise another issue and then pass on to other questions maybe? But so the solution that you were proposing about sort of reverse mortgages, mm-hmm. And now also what you suggested about self-employed people maybe being able to borrow against the, the accumulated contributions, the pension rights. Outside the issue of Greece, you know, these solutions are really going towards the kind of big financialization idea, which for many is the, you know, the the cause of the problem. You know, what brought us here is this excessive financialization, very complex products, you know, too much, you know, sort of borrowing from the future, all these things. And both things that you proposed are in this direction. And the standard may be, in the particular circumstance of Greece, you know, maybe any solution is a good solution. But besides that, is, you know, are we being too narrow in thinking on you know, yesterday's solutions, so to speak, about the future? You know, if the problem is aging and this, the demographic issue, would borrowing from the future be the answer, given that borrowing from the future caused the crisis or contributed to the crisis?
Yeah, but if you can't borrow from the future, you have to you can't borrow from the past.
You can borrow from the masses.
The financialization is a real issue because all of these proposals that essentially they take responsibility away from the state, and they transfer more of the power of decision to the people immediately involved. Now, this has an immediate problem of that the people who are given the probability to the potential to decide for themselves are not able to do that, because the extent of financial illiteracy in Greece, I think, is probably staggering. Well, certainly given by the extent of financial illiteracy in the government, you know. The population probably may be able to teach them a thing or two. But that is a serious. It's a serious problem, and one of my points about not going for something and saying, you know, that this is my solution, and we'll apply it next week, which is what everybody's trying to find at the moment. Even if you did have, and you were absolutely certain that you had the ideal solution, and you had it ready and written up on your computer, and you could just print it out next week, you shouldn't. Because you would first need to convince people, and first to explain, and to create the preconditions so that people are ready to digest such a thing. That is a question for the political economy, and the problem is, given you need time to prepare this, you need time to roll it out, but at the same time, if you have time and you leave it to the political system, they have all the centrifugal forces which are actually pulling you in exactly the directions you don't want to go. This is a problem. It's been met a number of times. What is the solution? Policy. what the Swedes, for example, thought when they passed their own pension reform. And the Swedish society is a society which is very used to social dialogue, and everybody's being very...
An astronaut social dialogue.
Yes. Everybody's being very civic-minded. But even so, they decided to bypass the social dialogue altogether. They just had... They invited representatives of political parties, with the exception of the, and they all responded with the exception of the Communist Party, which was something like 5%. And they took the representatives and shut them up in this hotel in the middle of nowhere, somewhere in North Sweden. And they said, you know, you just go there and you don't leave until you give us a solution. And they stayed 3 weeks, and they emerged with the Swedish system. And now, this annoyed both the employers and the trade unions no end, as you can imagine. But having decided that this is what they're going to do, being Swedish, what they did is they tested it first on Latvia. And they checked out that Latvia was still there. And only then did they decide to actually roll it along. It's been in operation for almost 15 years now. But, and this is one, the Swedish example is one of examples where you can say there is an extended pretend. Because the Swedish system says that when demographic change comes along, there are various things that will happen automatically. So replacement rates will fall, because what will happen automatically is that the technical rate of discount they use for calculating all their annuity factors, etc., will shift down. Now, it's not really sure that people in Sweden understand what this would mean, that would actually mean that their pensions will be much lower. The Swedish system is, in a sense, has pushed the problem forward. They know, I mean, in the same way, like everybody else knows that there is a looming problem in the future, and they've found a way to, as the Greek governments have done, just shift the decisions in the future. The Swedish system is very good at providing incentives for people to work longer, and because they get what they paid for. And there's an example that they also individualized all women's pensions, so that there are no survivor's pensions in Sweden at all. When the husband dies in a couple, the woman's pension is not affected at all. She keeps getting that. So what, and that was announced 15 years ago, and Sweden has already is beginning to have a problem of old age poverty among elderly widows. Women, even though the incentives have changed, and the incentives to work longer have changed, they keep behaving exactly the same way that they were behaving under the old system. They're leaving essentially what they're trying to do is leave at the same time as the husbands, and accepting much lower pensions.
We have just a bit more time, so unless there's a question from the audience, I'm going to ask my last question. So I have timed them very well. How about migration and the refugee crisis? So is the solution that comes from, not only for Greece, but also for Greece, from allowing people who are desperate to come and live and work maybe in Europe, letting
well,
them
in? I myself are someone who is a refugee from Egypt. And we were desperate, we were kicked out of Egypt, and some nice people accepted us. I don't think they regretted it, and I think the same thing would apply to the Syrians now. But the way that, I mean, it's not an economics issue, but I think the way that it's been handled by the political class in Europe is turning its back to a blessing. Because the Syrians are they're educated, they will adapt. In a place like Greece, they would also keep very active links with Syria in the same way that the Lebanese refugees who we accepted in the two civil wars in Lebanon, most of them went back to Lebanon, but they've kept very active links. Some stayed, and a lot of them, some have a house in Beirut and a house in Athens. And the same thing could happen with the Syrians.
But with the scale of migration needed, would it be, in order to ease the pressure on the pension system, are we talking doubling the population of Greece? So,
well, the pension, the easing the pressure is not just by changing the dependency ratio. I mean, it's difficult to change the pension because you read very large numbers of people. You could do things, and this is what happened in the previous wave of immigration in the 90s, that they developed a care industry, a sector of female immigrants providing care services, which allowed Greek women to leave the house and seek employment. So the and incidentally, it's one of the reasons, one of the reasons why there was an increase in the underlying rate of growth in the 90s. So, in addition to the sheer force of numbers, there are other more subtle ways that the aging process can be worked. And what is happening at the moment in Greece is actually the opposite, because the previous wave of migration are returning to Albania, Bulgaria, and so on. And these sorts of services now once again have to be performed by Greek women. They're not leaving the labor force yet, but they're in a pretty vulnerable position because they're trying to work more, and at the same time, what those time use the first analysis of the time use data shows is that they're working more in the labor market, but they're not working less at home.
Thank you very much for time. Platon, thanks again for the presentation and the very extensive discussion. And thanks to everybody for coming here. Let me, before you leave, announce the next two seminars that we have. We continue next week with our next seminar in the series by Antonin Selinas, who is also was visiting here, assistant professor at the University of Cyprus, on political developments in the rise of the Golden Dawn in Greece. And then there's another event on Tuesday, 8th of December, with Margot Salmon, associate professor here at LSE, on austerity, human rights, and international institutions, a very important topic, I think, about the legality of austerity in places like this. Thanks again, and Platon, thanks for the presentation.